This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 18th. Okay, good morning. I don't know what's going on. The attendance is terrible. It was terrible at 8 o'clock this morning, too. Is it the rain? Or just everybody wants to hibernate? It just seems to go in cycles. Anyway. All right. So, couple things. We have I didn't check this to see. I did assign the chapter 3. Yes, okay. Chapter 3 questions, problems from the textbook. There are lots of great problems there. I'd like to assign all of them, but if I did, you'd die. Folks. Yeah? Class has started? You would die if I assigned you all those problems, but do read through the problems and get a sense of the other ones as well. And also, as always, look at the review problems. And second of all, I don't know, people seem not to have ingested the idea of number of significant figures in answers from their high school chemistry classes or wherever you learn that now. People tend to produce answers that are purport to be accurate to far more decimal places than is warranted. So just watch out for that. And in problems 31 and 32, a couple decimal places of answers is certainly sufficient. Not interested in claiming accuracy that doesn't exist. Or precision that doesn't exist. Any questions? Good. So we will continue talking about transport layer stuff. There isn't a whole lot to say about UDP. UDP is a simple, small connection, small transport layer protocol layered directly over IP, and therefore its service includes lost datagrams, delivered out of order datagrams, etc. It does attempt to prevent delivery of datagrams that have been corrupted, but that mechanism is pretty weak. We'll see that in a second. Okay, so layered over IDP, over IP, there's no handshaking. You just fling segments at the receiver, and the receiver is free to do with them as it pleases. It's used in glue protocols. Remember, we talked about DNS as being an application layer protocol that is nevertheless kind of a glue protocol for the whole IP stack. You can use UDP for that. Why? Because typically when you look up the name of a machine, you don't care about a long stream of data that needs to be delivered reliably. You ask a simple question, you get a simple answer. And maybe you don't get that answer, but you could not get that answer because the network lost the packet or because the server didn't respond, and you have alternatives to ask the question of other servers. So why make things complicated by using TCP? That said, DNS also supports TCP. So, but typically people are using UDP to look at things up. SNMP is the Simple Network Management Protocol, not to be confused with SMTP, the Simple Mail Transport Protocol. This is a protocol that's used to query devices about their status on the network and so forth. Highly insecure, often turned off for that reason. Okay? If you want reliable transfer over UDP, you have to implement it at the application layer. So it goes. Okay, so what do you do to get to get UDP segments. You take the application data. Remember, it comes from the application layer above the UDP layer. So that's what comes in here. You stick on a transport layer header that consists only of the source port, destination port, the length, and a checksum. We'll talk about the checksum in a moment. And pass it down to the network layer. Okay? And remember the animations that show that then the network layer adds on a header that consists of the host addresses and so forth that then gets passed into the network. We've talked about why UDP, so that's a review. Okay, so the checksum idea is one that is widely used in networking at many layers. In this case, at the transport layer, what we're doing is providing a checksum that can be checked end-to-end on the data that's being sent. The idea of a checksum is to add some redundancy to a message so that you can tell whether it's been altered or not. It turns out that the particular kind of checksum that is used in UDP is, like I said, quite weak. It's easy to sort of purposefully go in and change the message, right? So an attacker, at least, can go in and change the message that's been sent and change the checksum successfully so that everything checks out, but it wasn't what was sent originally. But this was just a sort of an early on thing in the internet to say, suppose the network messed up, let's try to catch that. So the way it works is the sender computes something over the contents of the application data and the rest of the header, and it's called one's complement addition, and we'll look at how that works. It's not a big deal, and puts that calculated value into the message, into the header, and the receiver does that same computation and compares the number he gets with what was in the message, and if they match, it's okay, and if they don't, then the error is detected, and once an error is detected, the packet gets thrown away and never delivered to the application because it's clearly meaningless. So one's complement addition is just like two's complement addition, except that if there's a carry out from the high order bit, you add it back in to the low order bit. Okay? So it may again propagate through carries, as you see here. So I think there's a question about why this is a good idea. There are many other checksum algorithms that are much more capable than this one. I don't know if they say... Okay, they don't even say what sort of errors this detects, but certainly this will detect an error of one bit. Right? If a message changes by one bit, then this will detect the error. But there are much better ones that can do that. But this is fast and easy to calculate. I think these days, so there's a TCP checksum as well. These days, often the calculation of the checksum is handed off to the network adapter as part of the computation, so the CPU doesn't have to sort of march through every message and add up the words. Okay, any questions about UDP? It's very quick, but there's not much there. Not a lot to talk about. Okay, so we move on then to talking about reliable data transfer. And the question here is, how do you take a... How do you fill in all this stuff so that the perspective of the sending and receiving processes is that you have a reliable channel, but in fact it's implemented over an unreliable channel, because that's what IP is an unreliable channel. It turns out that just how unreliable the channel is and how it is unreliable, that is, the characteristics of the channel, make a great deal of difference to what you have to do in all of this stuff to achieve this. So that's what we're going to talk about. So the model then is that from the perspective of the sending process, it will make calls. And remember, we're stepping away from TCP here. This is principles discussion rather than this TCP specific. The sending process will make calls to a function called reliable data transfer send, and there will be some code implementing a protocol that lives sort of below this interface. And it will then make a call to unreliable data transfer send. And on the other side, we will receive. I wonder why they said RDT receive. I don't know why they called it that. I would have called it UDT receive. But anyway, you do a receive operation, get the data back into the protocol, do whatever you have to do here, and then deliver the data up to the application. And the fiction that you will be achieving is that it will look like you have a reliable channel even though you don't have one. So there's our picture. I just went through this. Send in into the protocol. We send downward. We pass the receiving data upward and ultimately deliver it. Okay, so we're gonna develop this thing in at least three versions, depending on different kinds of unreliable channels. And we're only going to talk about protocols that send data in one direction, so from a specific sender to a receiver. Remember, TCP itself is bidirectional, but TCP achieves that essentially by duplicating all of this mechanism in both directions. Right? So a little bits of optimization, but mostly duplicate everything in both directions. So it will take data flowing in one direction, but there will be protocol messages that also come back in the opposite direction. And we're going to use a finite state machine model to talk about what happens here. So is everybody familiar with finite state machines? Yeah? Okay. Talked about this in what? 317? Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, all right. of course, 317. But we're going to do something a little bit different than what they do in 317, in that we're going to allow the transitions between states to specify not only the event that causes the transition, but also some actions to be taken when that transition is made. So that's new. This is sort of more moving into the realm of finite state machines as understood by computer engineers instead of computer theorists. Okay, so circles are states. They're labeled. Transitions are labeled with the thing that causes a state transition and the actions to be taken when you do that. Okay, so we start with a perfectly reliable underlying channel with no errors and no loss of packets and no reordering, and we specify the finite state machines for the sender and receiver. Okay, so So, takes a single state on both sides. The state for the sender is wait for a call from above. When a call from above comes in, when a call from above comes in, it's this RDT send thing. Says make a packet out of the data and send it and go back into the same state. Right. Very simple. On the other side, the receiver is waiting for the RDTC receive call to come up from the unreliable stuff, unpack the data, deliver it, and go back into the same state. All right, so what's new here that you didn't say in 3.17 is that we have two finite state machines and they are interacting. Okay, so that's new stuff. Okay, so the next thing to try is what happens if the channel, the unreliable channel, may change some of the bits in the packet, right? And we don't want to deliver bad packets to the user, so we need a way to recover from those errors. And the way we're going to do that is to use acknowledgments from the receiver back to the sender that said that was okay. Or we're going to use negative acknowledgments from the receiver back to the sender that said that was not okay. You can design protocols around either style. And the sender will retransmit in the case of a NAC. In the case of ACTS, if the receiver doesn't acknowledge a message, what is the sender going to do? It's going to have some way of noticing that it didn't get that ACK, and that would typically be a timeout. Okay? So, in RDT 2.0, right, the second version, is we've added error detection and we've added the feedback ACK and NAC messages. So now we have more complicated finite state machines. We start out in the state where we're waiting to send data. When we get that call, RDT send, we make a packet and we send it, and then we go into a state where we're waiting for ACK or NAC, and you receive something and it's a NAC, then you have to send again. You receive an ACK, then you go back to waiting so you're able to send more data. The receiver remains simple. If it's a good packet, it sends an ACK. If it's a bad packet, it sends an ACK. Okay, so that's easy. What's the lambda? Lambda here means nothing to do. Empty. Okay. All right, so I think there's some arrows on this slide. We start there. Get that, do that, and okay, but if there's an error, oh, they are so clever. Do there, do that, do some there. So you can see that you could stay in this state for a long time as long as you keep getting NAC back. Okay, this protocol is dealing with an unreliable channel that at least always delivers messages, right? Suppose that we're going to move on to this kind of channel here in a second, but suppose that the channel sometimes just dropped messages. What would happen in this protocol?
Timeout from the sender, so that
Right. It with this protocol as it is, it would just sit there and be what we call deadlocked, right? Because there are no more messages going to come to move anybody out of the state that they're in. Another problem here is, remember that we said this channel could corrupt the ACK and NACK messages. This channel could corrupt any messages, right? Not just the ACK and NACK messages, but we are positing that the channel can tell if it has corrupted the messages using the checksum. So, what happens if you get a corrupted message? Well, suppose you were to retransmit, right? Then go back here. Suppose that you got a corrupted ACK or NACK here and decided to treat it like a NACK. Okay? Then you would resend this message, but you would be sending it to a receiver who had already delivered that message. The receiver wouldn't know that it was a duplicate, and therefore it would duplicate the message up to the application using this code. All right? So we don't want that, because that would be we would not have built a reliable channel over an unreliable channel. Okay. So to handle that, we can extend RDT 2.0 to say that if the ACK or NACK is corrupted, we'll treat it as a NACK, but we will also add a sequence number to each packet so that the receiver can tell whether it's a duplicate or not. Well, now things are starting to get complicated, but. I think we'll see the state machines for this in a second. But this protocol goes by the name of stop and wait, because the sender sends and then waits for a response before going on with the next message. All right. So now we're up to a four state machine for the sender. Excuse me. A four-state machine for the sender. It has two states waiting for incoming messages, and it has two states waiting for... Sorry. It has two states waiting for incoming messages, and it has two states waiting for ACKs or NACKs. And basically, what this says is that the sequence number has to match up. Right? You have to get an ACK or NACK that you're expecting, and you have to get, and we'll see on the receiver side, you have to receive a message that you're expecting, has a sequence number that you're expecting. If you don't, what do you do? Well, this is always the question. Remember I said, whenever you get something, you have to know what you're going to do with it. And in this case, let's see if I can find it. We're waiting for zero. And it has sequence number zero. We will acknowledge it. That's fine. If we're waiting for zero and it has sequence number one, Yes. If it has sequence number one, that's a retransmission from the sender, but we know that we've already delivered sequence number one, so we just acknowledge that we got it. We don't deliver it. So look at the difference between this little bit of code and this little bit of code. Okay? So the conditions are the same for these two, right? But when you're waiting for one, you deliver it, and in the case that you were waiting for zero, you don't. But you do acknowledge it. Because what this means is that the sender did not receive the acknowledgement that you sent the first time successfully. Okay, so what did we have to do? We had to add the sequence number. Two sequence numbers are enough because we never move out of the waiting for zero ACK state until we've got a zero ACK, and we never move out of the waiting for zero packet state until we've got a zero, and so we're always in one state or the other. We have to check every message to see if it's corrupted, and we've doubled the number of states. Okay. This is actually an interesting observation. The receiver cannot know if its last ACK or NACK was ever received at the sender. And so the protocol has to be designed around that fact. This is actually a deep theoretical result that essentially two distributed parties like this without time synchronization can never actually agree on anything in a guaranteed way that has to do with their last interaction. So that's kind of fun. But anyway. It's possible to modify this protocol so that it uses only ACKs. By essentially having the receiver send an ACK with the sequence number that it with the sequence number for the last packet that it received. Okay? And so when you receive a duplicate ACK at the sender, you gotta think about this. The sender has sent something, it's already got back an ACK message. Okay? If it gets another one, it means that what? Why would it, in this protocol, why would the sender get another ACK? Well, to answer that, you have to ask yourself, what does the receiver do? What causes the receiver to produce an ACK? What? It got a packet. Okay? What would that packet have been? It would have been the other packet than the one that was being acknowledged, but it must have been corrupted. That would be the only thing that would cause the receiver to produce another ACK message in this protocol. Now, different protocols work differently, so you gotta, okay. Here they're just showing, I'm sorry, I got confused by the word fragments here. They're talking about fragments of the state machine. They're just showing you one half of the state machine here. The other half would be symmetrical. You can look in the book or look at the slides later. Okay, So far, so good. We have 4-state sender and a 2-state receiver. But now let's suppose that the unreliable channel can also lose packets. Not going to reorder packets, but it's going to lose packets. What do we need? Well, we need everything we needed before, certainly, but that's not enough. And we alluded to this before, that if something doesn't arrive after a reasonable amount of time, we have to retransmit. But the complication this engenders, of course, is that suppose that we do a timeout, we do the retransmission, and now, in fact, that packet shows up. Okay? So that will look like a duplicate. And it will cause duplicates to be sent, but our sequence number stuff already took care of that. But again, we just have to be careful to specify exactly what it is that we're acting. Alright? So, this requires, typically in the operating system, some sort of support for timers and asynchronous interrupts to tell these finite state machines that now is time to resend. Okay, so, still a 4-state machine, but we add an additional timeout transition into the waiting for ACK states, and it just says, you know, resend the packet. So our timeline, this is one of those timeline diagrams that shows what happens. Okay, so ordinary stuff. Two separate cases here. This is the no loss case. This is the loss case. So some time goes by. Timeout. Resend. Okay? Straightforward. Suppose an acknowledgement is lost. Again, there's a timeout. We resend, resend a duplicate ACK, and then we're ready to go on again. And suppose that there's a delayed ACK. We resend, now we get the acknowledgement. Now we see it's a duplicate. It gets complicated, and the thing about these protocols and these finite state machines is it is never obvious once you get to something even this complicated that you've done it right. Right? Because doing it right means that in fact you have covered all the possible cases that could occur as far as losses and the timing of losses. And so, when I say it's never possible, it's never possible just by simple inspection to know that. You really have to go through the analysis and draw out all of these diagrams and say, okay, what does my protocol do in all of these cases? And it's funny, but for many years, people didn't have computer-aided tools for designing protocols like this. And there were many protocols that were proposed and even used that had timing flaws of various kinds in them that would lead to deadlocks or bad data delivery. So it took quite a while in the history of networking to figure out how to automate the testing of these finite state machines and make sure that you really covered all of the possible cases. Okay. So this protocol is correct. It always, you know, it successfully delivers things, delivers them reliably. But performance-wise, it is really bad. Okay? So, this is kind of an extreme case, thinking about a gigabit per second link, 8K bit packets, the transmission time is 8 microseconds, right? Trust me. Trust them. I did do this. We'll trust them. Okay, the utilization, remember, is figured out as the transmission time over the round trip time plus the transmission time. And so the utilization here is .027%. Right? Really, this is an expensive link. And you're getting this much value out of it. All right? Not good. Gets worse if the round trip time goes up. Okay. So this would not be a good protocol to use over such a link. So what's going on? It's another one of these diagrams, and I think we've looked at this before, right? About the this is the transmission time, this is the propagation time. Yeah, we went over that. And so your utilization is this much over this much. This little bit over this big bit. It's your utilization. Bad news. And it's because of stop and wait, right? The way this protocol works is you send this and then you wait for the acknowledgement before sending packet one. Okay, so to overcome that, what we have to do is, and we've seen this in a simpler version before, we have to have some way that essentially fills up the pipe, right? If you just stick that little bit of data into the pipe, it's like a slug moving through the pipe, right? And at any given point, this data is at some position within the pipe as it moves along, but the pipe is mostly empty. So to overcome that, we have to fill up the pipe. And to do that, we need to have a range of sequence numbers. We need more than just 0 and 1. We need a whole lot of them. We need enough to count all the packets that are in flight and all the ACKs that are coming back. excuse me. And so there are two forms of these pipelined protocols called go back N and selective repeat. And the issue is, what happens if, you know, we're getting all these packets and one of them is suddenly missing? What are we going to do? How are we going to recover from the loss of that packet, or similarly from the loss of an acknowledgement? So, to increase utilization, we have to have more packets in flight at once. We have more ACKs coming back. Having three packets triples the utilization. That's fine. So, go back in. The idea is the sender is sending packets without waiting for acknowledgments, right? Eventually, it's going to have to wait for acknowledgments, but it has this parameter capital N that says that's how many packets it's willing to have outstanding without having gotten acknowledgments. In the go back N version of the protocol, the receiver acknowledges the last contiguous packet that it's received. So if there's a gap, if the receiver has received a bunch of packets and then it misses some and then it starts receiving more, it just keeps acknowledging the last one that it received before the gap. And the sender eventually notices that it hasn't gotten an ACK for some packet, and when it does that, it goes back to that point and starts sending again. Now, it's simple, but what's bad about it is that the sender, the receiver may have actually gotten many of those packets that came after the gap, and so you're wasting resources to reset them. So selective repeat extends this so that the receiver sends an ACK for each packet, a different ACK for each packet. It acknowledges packets that it gets that follow the gap, and the sender resends only the unacknowledged packets after a timeout. When we look at TCP, we're going to see some variations on both of these things, because neither one of these is completely ideal in practice. So it's useful to get your heads around these diagrams. One of the issues here is that in any given protocol, we are only going to allocate a certain number of bits for sequence numbers in packets. We sort of have to do that. Well, I suppose you could have a protocol that allowed a variable number of bits for the sequence number, but the result of that would be that we essentially allowed sort of arbitrarily long distances and gaps, and that's not good either. We can design protocols with finite k, so that's what we do. So at any given time, the sender has the following picture going on. It has sent some data, and that has all been ACKed, right? Because that's the way go back end works. When you get an ACK for this packet, it means that you've received, that everything before that has been received. So we have a certain point where we've received ACKs for everything that came before that. We have a bunch of packets that have been sent, but we haven't received ACKs yet. And then we have a bunch more slots for packets that we could send, but we haven't sent them yet. So so in the sender, we have to keep track of these three things. We have to keep track of the first unacknowledged packet. We have to keep track of the next packet, the sequence number of the next packet that we're going to send, and we have to keep track of the window size. And that gives us the ability to have this picture in mind. And then beyond the window size, there are packets that can't be sent yet because it's just not allowed. Okay. Yes. The timer is associated with this oldest in-flight packet. The first yellow one in here is the earliest sent packet that has not yet been acknowledged. And when that timer goes off, we start sending at this point and resend everything. Go back in. Now we're back to a one-state finite state machine, but it's kind of a lie. because it's a one-state finite state machine, but we have these variables like send base and next sequence number that really represent state. So it's a lie that it's a one-state finite state machine, because every different pair of values for these things is a different is actually a different state. You can ponder those conditions and actions. So the rules here are that the sender, the receiver always acknowledges the last correctly received packet, and that may cause it to generate duplicate acknowledgments. Therefore, it's only remembering what it's expecting next. If it gets something out of order, if it's a duplicate of something that it already got, no problem. It throws it away and doesn't do anything with it, but it does acknowledge again. If it gets something that's ahead of what it's expecting, same thing. It throws it away and re-acknowledges the last one that it successfully got. So again, complicated diagrams. If packet 2 here is lost and packet 3 is received, then what the receiver does is re-acknowledge number 1, the sender says, oh, okay, well, he already acknowledged that, so let's not worry about that because I've gone on beyond that. But after a certain amount of time, packet 2 is going to time out, at which time we resend everything that came after packet 2 and start getting back the acknowledgments. Okay, we will have to pick up with selective repeat next time. We will do that, and then we will move into talking about some of the details of how all this shows up in a real protocol, TCP.